Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on HighTruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an investigative conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Investigative, as in research and investigating for reporting. What is investigative journalism? I looked it up, and the major component of such journalism is systematic, in-depth, and original research and reporting, often unearthing secrets. Ooh, secrets. That always raises eyebrows. Some of my favorite High Truth guests have been journalists, and I have been very impressed with the level of research that goes into that job. So what are the secrets on fentanyl? I looked up investigative journalism on fentanyl and found an article on how and why fentanyl is ravaging America. And lo and behold, the expert in the article was my good friend from Homeland Security Investigation, Agent Ed Byrne, and who's a good friend in San Diego now in Hawaii. So that was kind of cool. But the research and investigation on fentanyl leads to drug cartels. Drug cartels in Mexico go hand in hand. And with more investigation, we find the People's Republic of China, under the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, directly subsidizes the manufacturing and export of illicit fentanyl materials and other synthetic narcotics through tax rebates. Mexico, China are involved in fentanyl. But what are our own domestic culpabilities? To learn more about investigative reporting, especially as it relates to drugs, I reached out to an expert, Sarah Carter. Sarah Carter is an investigative journalist who contributes to the Fox News Channel and hosts her own podcast, The Sarah Carter Show. Her stories range from national security, terrorism, immigration, and the High Truth's favorite, drug trafficking. Sarah's mother is Cuban, and so Sarah is fluent in Spanish. Her husband is a war hero, injured in Afghanistan, and she is mother to six children. To learn more about Sarah Carter, check out the High Truth show notes. Sarah Carter, welcome to High Truths.
Nice to be with you, Doctor. Thank you so much for having me on. It's such an honor.
I'm excited to have you. You've been waiting for a while. You do a lot of great work when it comes to drugs, addiction, fentanyl, and you're an investigative reporter. And I gave the audience a little preview of like what that means, but can you tell us, you could probably explain better, what is an investigative reporter?
I always say an investigative journalist, and especially now after all these years, more than 20 years, I keep saying more than 20, it's probably like 25 years, is almost like an intelligence officer, I would say, like somebody who collects information, right? And investigates that information. So let me explain a little. Like when I first began reporting, I was much younger. I was working in California. And in fact, I was just discussing this earlier today with a friend of mine. I was working in California. Right behind me, you'll see this right over here. There is a poster behind me. It says Jamie's Story. There was a killing in Pomona, California. It was a 15-year-old boy who went by the moniker Yogi. He had taken his father's weapon and taken his grandfather's car, from what I can remember, or taken his grandfather's weapon and car, and had gone down to Irwindale to the Pomona courthouse and had killed and executed an Irwindale police officer. This was like a shocking wave of crime that was happening in our community. And this was shocking to the community itself. This innocent officer going for a traffic ticket to court, comes outside, loses his life. What was happening in our community? Why would a 15-year-old do this? Did they know each other? No, they didn't. Why would he do this? So I started to investigate. I asked my editor, I was young. I said, look, I want to focus in on what's happening in our community. I want to be able to see why so many of our young people are joining gangs, why they're killing each other on the streets, why this young man would go so far to kill a police officer. And seeing my work, said, go ahead. I'm going to give you free rein. Get out there, find out what's going on. Let's start breaking some stories. I went out there with the intention of telling a story about, you know, gang life, what was happening in our community. I didn't realize the path that it would take me down. I didn't realize the amount of narcotics that were coming across the border, the powerful people that were within these communities that were running a lot of these young people and taking their lives from them, basically owning them as property to mule the drugs and to work in these illicit activities with members of like the Mexican mafia, like La MA and so forth. What I also didn't realize, and it was what I was discovering, during that time period as a very young investigative journalist, is how many more areas would be opening up. Stories that I never even realized were there. For example, Yogi couldn't read or write, yet he was in high school. How is it possible that a kid that couldn't even read the Jack in the Box, menu was passing his grades all the way through and was in high school? How is that possible? How is it possible that, the school district would have no programs or didn't allocate the money appropriately when it came to just the schools itself? Filthy bathrooms, teachers that weren't teaching, children that were leaving school all day, yet somehow graduating and passing tests. I didn't even know what was going on there. So as an investigative journalist, I started peeling back layers of the onion on stories. And what that onion unfolded to me was an enormous problem that couldn't be just resolved by writing one story. It was multiple stories. And I was thinking, as a journalist, like, how do I tell this story so that it's palpable for the audience? Like, how do they understand all of these complexities? How do I tell it? And I did it through the voices of these children. And then I weaved in through their lives the tragedies that were unfolding, not only in their communities, but in our community as a whole. And I'm going to tell you, from that moment on, after publishing Jamie's story right here, and then this story behind me right here is the U.S. Special Forces for Special Rescues. We went ahead and started to uncover things that I think now are playing more prominently. Derek Maltz, a good friend of both of ours, he worked with the DEA, and, he's an amazing human being who has done so much incredible work in fighting the fentanyl scourge and what's happening and the loss of life for so many children across America.
Shout out to Derek, because he connected us.
Yeah, Derek connected us. And that's what's so great about all of this. I got to tell you, that's what happened. This is what happened to me. I was breaking these stories like Jamie's story. And all of a sudden I realized, that this was far more than just narcotics coming across our border, that during this time, and this is about 20 years ago, and then, of course, it was at the beginning of America's longest war, Afghanistan, what was happening in Iraq. I was talking to people in the intelligence community, in the DEA, writing my stories, talking to people in Mexico, and they were saying, hey, look, these narcotics traffickers, these organizations, these narco kingpins have connections all across the globe and is presenting a really dangerous scenario for us at the southern border. And I said, wow, well, that's a huge story. I mean, if there's some kind of connection between terrorism and our, and the narco traffickers and the potential risk that we face as a nation at the border, then I need to start investigating that. And I did. And I was breaking all these stories at the U.S.-Mexico border. So from Jamie's story on, I was breaking stories. I broke Mexican military incursions into the United States, where the Mexican military was actually aiding and abetting in some cases, in some parts, not the whole Mexican military, just some bad guys. You know, drug cartels move narcotics into our country or target some of our law enforcement. I broke those stories. And all of a sudden, these stories started to unravel because I'm investigating, right? I'm investigating. I don't go in with any presumptions. I'm not going in trying to prove a point at that point. I'm trying to tell stories. I'm trying to find out what's going on. Why are our children dying? Why are there so many problems when it comes to our southern border, despite the money that our government puts into it, despite our law enforcement? What are we seeing there? What's happening in our communities where 15-year-olds are not only killing each other, but they're killing cops? And all of a sudden, a whole new onion unfolds. And I get a call from the Washington Times, this was many years ago, and they said, hey, we're watching what you're doing. You're breaking all these stories along the border. Would you like to come work for us? And I said, yeah, I'll come work for you. I'll move to Washington, D.C. and bring my family with me, because I was a late bloomer. I said, but I want to cover the war in Afghanistan. I want to go in as a Pentagon correspondent, and this is the reason why. And I laid out those facts. I said, I believe there's a nexus between drug cartels and terror organizations and our adversaries overseas. I believe that the border is going to be a potential huge hotbed problem for the United States if we don't solve the problem now. And that is what I want to do. And they almost did not say yes. Luckily, they had a position, but I was, I think, the first female correspondent for the Washington Times to go overseas into the war zone. And I began covering the war there from, late 2007, early 2008, up until, I was still going into war zones in 2015. I ended up in...
is that how you met your husband? Because I know your husband's a war hero, but is that the connection there?
Yeah, it was tough on him. It was tough on me. I mean, we were both in the war zone together. We met overseas in Afghanistan, believe it or not. And he is the most incredible man. In fact, today is his birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
While we're talking. And, you know, he is somebody who has put his life on the line. I can't even tell you how many times, in love of his country and in love of what this nation stands for. And, you know, he was out there fighting the fight against the war on terror. And this was, he's a special operator. So he was with Delta Force and with other agencies. And he was wounded in Afghanistan, actually on Easter Sunday, 2011. He almost lost his life, but he lost his eyesight. And, you know, Marty and I guess we've always known the risks that we took, even with having children, we took those risks. Not, and I want to put this the right way, they were mitigated by the fact that we always said, is it worth this? Like, what I'm doing right now, is it worth the risk? Is what I am doing going to change life for somebody else? Is it going to educate, especially for me, the American public? Is it going to give them some kind of knowledge that they wouldn't find someplace else? It wasn't just about, getting out into the war zone or the thrill of war or the addiction to doing things that are kind of edgy or, and I do believe that I may have a little bit of that adrenaline junkie in me. I admit that. Otherwise I probably wouldn't have been in some of the places I've been in my life, but it was really about the future of our nation, the future for my children, and what I had seen growing up. That affected me. And that's really what led me into investigative journalism. And that's what keeps me motivated, is that I believe that, I used to think, doesn't everybody do this? I used to think every other reporter was traveling the world and, going up on Sinjar, going up to cover the war on Islamic State, until I got there. And then I was like, wow, I'm the only woman here with all these men. This is great.
It's dangerous.
And then every once in a while, I'd run into a female reporter like Kelly Kennedy or, somebody else that was out there, Lara Logan or in Afghanistan or somebody. And I would be just like so grateful. I'm like, wow, women, we're going to tell a story from a different angle. But we had to put everything kind of on the line, and we had to realize every time we went out in the field, whether that was in Mexico covering the drug cartels, or whether that was in Afghanistan covering the rise of the Taliban and then the fight between the United States and Taliban and the, you know, the narcotics issues. I covered a lot of that. I covered opioid addiction with women and children in Afghanistan. It was a huge story for me. And a friend of mine, Mary Calvert, who did the photographs, it was absolutely astonishing. Wasn't just in America. There was addiction in Afghanistan as well, because of hunger, because of pain, because of, you know, there were, they didn't have the same resources we had. So it was telling stories from a, you know, from a unique angle and unpeeling those layers of the onion, and then just really diving deep into that and uncovering stories that I never even knew existed. It was almost like a terrifying treasure trove, right? Of stories. Like, I had no idea this was happening. And then when I would be the first to break that story, it was a little scary, a little exhilarating, but you got to be right. You know, you can't just write things down. You have to triple check them. You have to get experts on the record to prove what you're, you know, what you're seeing is actually really what you're seeing. You know, I mean, this is, it's a tough job, but it was, and it still is, but it's so worth it, because I believe that by doing this, by putting light on an issue, we are actually disinfecting, right? It is the greatest disinfectant, is the truth. And the truth is the most important resource that we have in a republic, in a democracy, is to get that out and allow the people to make the best decisions for themselves and to expose malfeasance, you know, at every level. And that is what our job is supposed to be.
That's awesome. I love it. We can all tell the passion that you have for that, with the venture and for the mission. So, and and how one story leads to another layer of the onion. And you've done that, Sarah. I kind of like, I'm thinking that I followed you because you started out as a California girl, it sounds like, in the Inland Empire. That's where I went to high school, Redlands High School.
And then gosh, yes, Redlands. I loved it. And I was actually when I very, very first started at the Daily Bulletin, Norco was my area of coverage. So I was covering Norco, and the Press Enterprise was the big competitor out there.
It's funny because I was like watching all little YouTube videos that I could find of you and watching your podcast in preparation. And I came upon this interview from you 17 years ago when you were a young girl in the Inland Empire. And like, oh.
Very young and still somewhat naive and not realizing what the future had in store.
But you were adventurous then too. You were going at the drug cartels. But also you did this. And you have six children. How do you, for the women out there, how did you balance, you know, a successful career and family?
I have amazing children, and I have an amazing husband, and I feel so fortunate that I had the ability to do this. It was not easy. It was not easy. I had great family support too. So when my mother was alive, you know, she would help when the oldest ones were very young, and I could get out on the road for a little bit. And it wasn't easy. I mean, when I first started, I always tell people, you know, I did not come from a family with a silver spoon in my mouth. No, my father passed away when I was 13 years old. We were lucky because he worked for Lockheed Martin. We got to live overseas for a while. I lived in Saudi Arabia for a while, if you want to call that lucky. I got to see a lot of the world. I loved it. Maybe that's where my sense of adventure came from. My dad worked, he's a mechanic on planes for Lockheed Martin. And he passed away when I was 13. My mom had to go back to work. She went back to a factory to work. We lived in Montclair, California at the time. And, you know, that area was definitely inundated, especially in Pomona and other areas, with a lot of gang activity. But I had a beautiful family that was really strong and a mother who worked really hard, to give me a life. And then I learned to do that with my children. You know, my mom worked really hard. She wasn't always there like 24/7. She wasn't always hovering over me, but she established rules and you didn't mess with her. Because if you did, she would show up at like whatever house you were lying and saying you were at, because she would find you. My mom was a great investigator. A Cuban investigator is what I call her. She would find me anywhere. So maybe that's where I got some of my investigative skills from. And so, you know, I try to teach my children, and I was talking to my husband about this the other night. We're like, all of our kids, you know, because we're a blended family. We said all of our kids are like us. You know, we all get along. We all, even if we have disagreements a little bit, like politically, we all pretty much feel the same way. They're so proud of us, you know, and they're doing their own thing, and they're so independent. And I'm grateful for that. I think, like, as a family, we make time for each other when we're together, but we also realize that we all have special gifts to offer. And I felt like my gift was, you know, going out there and being a journalist. That was my calling, being a writer. And I was so blessed. And believe me, I started it after my kids. So I did not have, I'm telling you, for anybody else who's out there looking, I had no idea this was going to be my life. I had no idea I'd be uncovering stories and going to, you know, Mexico and covering the drug cartels, or, you know, sitting in the middle of a war zone in Afghanistan. I mean, I was a kid that, you know, my mom worked in a factory. I remember when I got pregnant before I got married. Let's just be, you know, straight up. And I got married to my first husband, and who was, we're still friends, great friends. Hi, Dave. We're still all friends. But I had, you know, I did things a little bit backwards to go forwards, and I knew what it was like. You know, I know what it's like. I know what it's like to struggle. I know what it's like to make $8 an hour and try to make ends meet. Yes, $8 an hour. I was making that when my son was really young. And I know what it was like to finish school later. And I know what it was like to go through tough times. And I know what it was like to see addiction in my own family and to see it, you know, with friends, and to see what it was like and to know and to feel what it was like to struggle, you know, to watch my mom struggle and to make those payments every month and to give us a better life. And I think that kind of established me for the role as a mother. You know, you asked like how I did that. It established me as a role as a mother, because life is not always easy. It's not always perfect. You know, we have to be ready to accept like great challenges. And I did, you know, and sometimes not very good. Like I accept those challenges, but I realized there was times I could have been a lot better at accepting them. And that's what I try to teach my kids, and kind of, that's how the job affected me and my children. I wish you could talk to them and maybe you would get a different answer. Like maybe they would have wanted mom around just a little bit more on certain times. Yeah, I'm sure. But when I talk to them now, they're always like, even my youngest, she's 11. And she's our youngest of all of them. And we go from 34 to 11. How do you figure that? And she was our surprise baby. She's like, oh, mom, you're never going to quit reporting, are you? You're never going to quit. She's like excited for me. I'm like, really? You want me to just...
They're proud of you. Your kids are proud of you.
Yeah, they are. And I'm proud of them. And I want them to feel that way. And I want them to feel that way as future moms and, you know, strong women for my daughters. And I want my sons to look at women and go, you know what? I want to be with a strong, wonderful woman, whatever she decides to do. If she decides to become a doctor, if she decides to be a house mom, if she wants to just garden for the rest of her, be the best gardener in the world. I just think like people should do what makes them, for the most part, happy. But you also have to realize, just as I'm sure you know, doctor, because of what you cover all the time, that life is filled with so many challenges, and we can't expect life to be perfect. And nobody's life is perfect. No one's. I don't care who they are. I don't care if they're Brad Pitt. I don't care how good looking they are, wherever they're from. They are not, they do not live perfect lives. That's just not reasonable. It's not real. And I think in a world today where everybody thinks other people are like living the high life and everything's great, we know social media and stuff, I think people need to realize now you can really get up in the morning, have hair like me, like right now, I've been working all day. I was like, I don't even have time to style my hair for the doctor.
No, but
I'm
going to be on the show. That's one thing I was going to say. As a Fox News reporter, there's something there about all the news reporters are on TV. You have to look good. You have to be pretty.
Except me. Because there are so many times when I get on TV and I'm like, I cannot believe I'm on TV right now with Sean and I'm looking like this. I'm like dripping in sweat. I've got a baseball hat on my head. I've got gnats flying around my face at the border. One of them just took a trip inside my mouth and decided to set up shop. I have no idea what's going on. So there are many times where I'm grateful that I've learned from the Fox makeup artists and some of their hair people. Like when I have to do my own, which is what I do. When I'm at home, do my own makeup, do my own hair. You could see the difference. She was like, oh, she must be a
I always. I think my audience knows that I do it myself. That's why it looks
you
looks
look
good.
Fantastic. What are you talking about? You know, but it's like, it's about just realizing that I don't do this. I didn't do it. I never did it to be on television. It was never, ever in my game plan. Like I never sat there and said, wow, I can't wait to be on TV one day. I never even, listen, I'll tell you a little secret that's going to be all over your show now, but I never studied this, like in college. Like I never studied, I never did teleprompter work. I never studied it on camera. I never did any of that. I just fell into all these jobs. I used to say it was, what is that, trial by fire?
Yeah.
No, seriously, trial by fire. First time national television, Sinclair News Group, they just told me, oh, yeah, you're going to go on and read this. And I was like, read what? And they're like, oh, a script. They're going to put it up there. I'm like, I have never done this before. I am an investigative journalist and I don't do this. And they put me up there. And believe it or not, I know I talk a lot, but I ran out of breath like three times on. And you could literally tell I was running out of breath because there was no grammar in the read. There was no pauses. There was nothing. I was just trying to survive.
So you've had a very successful and continued successful career in journalism. A lot of people now look at journalism and don't know what to trust. And they say that there's no such thing as non-biased journalism anymore, that every media outlet, whether it's TV, newspaper, or I guess TikToks, they all have an angle. And they're showing their opinion, not just the news. Like I think of like the old Walter Cronkite days of the news where things were just, just the facts, only the facts and not commentary. And now things are, do you, as one of the journalists out there, do you agree with that sentiment that
Oh, sure. I mean, there's been a massive shift in how news has been reported. And I think we saw a lot of that over the last decade or so, how it changed. But it's been changing now for quite some time. We saw the shifts with, I think, media from early morning, talk shows where people want to get up in the morning and they want to hear the news, but they want it to be fun. So they want, they watch the person that they most associate with. And I think that right now, I think there was a Pew poll. I wish I could remember the numbers on it, but it was drastic. It was like so many more people want to know the political opinion of the person they're watching in the news. And that's coming from the public, because I think that the public's worried, like, I just don't want to be bamboozled by anyone. Someone who says that they're going to be objective, but yet they have, they're not objective in the way that they're actually delivering the message. I think there's damage on both sides when it comes to that. I think it's important to know that, when I decided finally to come out and state my opinions, I'm more of an investigative columnist now. So I have an opinion. I'll still base it all on facts, but I do have opinions, which was far different than the young girl that was just reporting in the newspapers, which was just, an editor would oversee the story. They would say, okay, do you have three sources for this? Three sources, at least minimal for that. And then they would double, triple, quadruple check everything and make sure that the story had both voices, a balance between, the whatever opposition was in that story. I think we need that. We still need that. We still need just the facts. We also need to not be afraid to stand up for when things are wrong. And I think what's happened in America, and especially like what throughout my career, and I'm still trying to piece all the facts together, but I remember, you know, covering stories where I would be sitting back and we would break a story, John Solomon and I would break a big story or something. And then I would say, this is going to be the biggest story in political history. I mean, the New York Times is going to jump on it. The Washington Post, we're going to lose the story because we won't have the resources like they do to follow up on it. And then they didn't do it. And I was like, wait a minute. I wasn't doing it for any political reason. I didn't know any of these guys. I don't hang out with people. I don't hang out with, like, you know, I wasn't like I said, I'm not the rich kid, right? I didn't go to like, I wasn't in New York hanging out with, you know, the Trumps or the whoever's or the, you know, I mean, I wasn't, not that that wouldn't be fun. I'm sure it would be a lot of fun, but I just wasn't in that realm. That wasn't who I was. But when I start breaking those stories and I know the legitimacy of the story, I know that the story is factual. I know that it's true. I know what I have is solid. It's like I could present it to a court, right? I was really interesting. I was watching a fascinating documentary right now on Netflix that's out. It's all on the Nuremberg trials. And, you know, it's just, it goes right to your point. You know, and the Nuremberg trials, you know, charging all the accomplices that were involved with Adolf Hitler and, you know, and how they were bringing that to the forefront of the public, you know, and how the lawyers and everybody were looking for the tapes and the proof and what was happening in Germany and Nazi Germany and how were they going to prove it. And you see these amazing tapes and you see the facts and then you hear the accomplices and they're just with this, like these despicable ideas, and but they're so open and they're talking about it and they're talking about, you know, how they operated in Nazi Germany, and you're watching it and you're like, yes, this is truth. This is truth. This is truth. It's documented history. Nobody can ever forget it because they have the facts. And I think, like, for me, that's what's so important as a journalist. And for journalists who are young and who are working out there now, who are going to break stories, we have to have facts and proof. And we have to be able to show that proof to the public and be able to, for the public to understand what we're delivering them. And unfortunately, I think now we've kind of lost our way. I do think the pendulum will swing back. And I think we're going to get back to some solid newsmaking. And eventually people will, you know, will find a balance, I think, again, because I fear if we don't get back to that point, you know, it's going to be dangerous for a republic. We can't have a republic. We can't educate, that we can't feel free in educating with accuracy and with facts. Mm-hmm. And that means the government staying out of it as well. I mean, the American people are pretty smart. You know, we do not need, you know, the purveyors of disinformation controlling.
It's interesting that you as a journalist want government out of your business. Me as a doctor, I want government out of my business, too. I don't think.
Right.
Yeah. As a physician, whenever the government plays doctor, it doesn't go well.
Right. Right. Because we as people can make the right decisions for ourselves. I'm never going to pick up. You know, as long as I have the facts and as long as there could be people that oversee things, right, that can fact check. Yes, fact check that. But I will fact check anybody, like on that Nuremberg trial. It's like, here's the facts. Here are the facts. And here are the facts when it comes to narcotics trafficking in the United States that we have so far. Or here are the facts when it comes to terrorism and what I was not only able to write about, but I witnessed myself with my own eyes. And then sometimes people are surprised because I come back with stories and I'm like, it's amazing. You know, I met the most wonderful people in Afghanistan and they're still my friends and I will help them and do whatever I can. And we brought some to the United States, you know, that we were able to, by the grace of God, save, you know, because they would have been killed. But there are stories that, you know, that are, that I think would surprise people, but that comes with actually seeking the truth, not sitting behind a desk, writing a story, or listening to somebody on the other phone line at the Department of Defense or somewhere like the NIH or anywhere, just telling us what those facts are. You know, it's actually going out there and investigating. Probably like the, you know, people like at the CDC would investigate a virus, right? Like, where did it start? Why is it mutating? Where do we need to go to investigate this? You know?
Yeah, they have a whole system of doing that for any outbreak, right. Any outbreak.
Right.
But tell us about what you learned through your, you have amazing experience throughout many years with related to drugs, and you said cartels and gangs. But what do we know today in today's, you know, drug market that we have here in the United States? A lot of it's coming internationally. What can you teach us about the drug cartels from Mexico and the Chinese Communist Party? And I assume that those are the two big players.
They are. And I've never felt so disheartened or jaded in a long time in my life. You know, I've been covering these stories for a long time. I can't even begin to tell you, Doctor, how many congressional hearings I've been to, ones that have been based on my stories, some of them, ones that have been based on evidence of, you know, malfeasance at play or national security concerns at the border, and believing every single time, like, this is it, they're going to fix it. This is it, they're going to put American children and children in general, right? In general, because I cover the border. My mother was from Cuba. I speak Spanish fluently. I get it. I know how life is and how tough it is for people, not just in America, but all over the world, you know? And I understand that. I have empathy. But what I have seen at that border is nothing short of like the worst dereliction of duty in the history of this country, a failure on such grand scales. And I don't blame it on just any one person. Although I think now it's far worse in the last 4 years than it has been. But I think a failure of epic proportions that falls on the shoulders of all of the political players in the United States and others. The skyrocketing deaths, we've known for decades, our adversary is China. We've known for decades that the drug cartels in Mexico have amassed resources that far exceed our own law enforcement resources. We have known for decades that this is going to be probably one of the biggest, and I don't want to say potentially because that's not the right word, that this would be the biggest national security crisis that our nation would face. And yet they did nothing about it. Yet they did absolutely nothing about it. They being our government and as well us, the American people. We kind of just ignored it. And people didn't want to talk about the use of narcotics and what was happening in our country because they were afraid.
Are you specifically talking about that attack, I would call it attack, of fentanyl on our country, where fentanyl is the number one cause of death, ages 18 to 45. It's killing more Americans than anything in that age group.
Yes, and it's a proxy war by China, in my opinion. This is a proxy war by the CCP against the American people, because this amount of fentanyl and precursor chemicals that goes into Mexico does not come into the United States without the knowledge of the CCP. And the CCP is well aware of the amount of people that have been fleeing, so-called fleeing China, and coming through our Darien Gap and making their way through Mexico and into the United States, over 50,000 of Chinese, mostly military-age males, coming into the United States. And the marijuana grows that we're seeing all across the country by supposed illicit Chinese gangs or Chinese trafficking organizations that cannot operate without the knowledge of the CCP. So I think we are effectively, honestly, at war in a weird way. It's a proxy war. And the United States knows it, but it's the Trojan horse, right? It came into our country. It set up shop. It unloaded, And now it's killing our children.
Well, it's not the first time the world has seen war because of drugs, right? We've had the opium wars, two of them. Interestingly enough, China was on the receiving side, right? Their population. That's right. Their population was addicted. They asked, please don't sell your, you know, bring your poppy seeds and opium to our country, where I think up to 25% of men were addicted at the time. And right. It wasn't the United States. It was UK and France and India at the time say, no, this is an important commodity for us. We're not stopping. And I'd say, I don't know if it's directly if anybody else is saying it, but is this payback time? Like, well, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. That's what China said. And instead of being victims of opium, they became the exporters.
Right. And I think they were very, I think it was a real, that is a really valid point. And I've heard this before, but I think that what China did was it learned, right? It learned that this is a weapon that can be utilized against a population. But I don't blame them as much as I blame ourselves. It's like, how do we know that this is, it's like saying, okay, I get it. I've got a neighbor that is possibly a sex predator in our neighborhood, but I'm going to let them babysit my kids.
That's a great analogy.
Right?
I'm glad that we
wouldn't do that.
So there's the foreign threats, the international threats on our country with China and Mexico. They're producing. They're the biggest importers of drugs. But I like that you agree that we have a culpability too. We need deterrence, right?
Absolutely. We need deterrence. We need to start educating ourselves, but we also have to be very realistic. If you have a border wide open and no one's doing anything to stop it, and you're not facing the reality, we're selling our land off to our adversaries, openly selling our land, because nobody can tell me that it was just because some intermediaries came in and nobody knew what was going on. That's not true. I talked to farmers. I talked to ranchers. They knew what was going on. If they knew what was going on, our government knew what was going on, because they were complaining. They're like, wait a minute, how did this guy get all this land right around here? Or, you know, I can't drive around Laughlin Air Base here in Texas, you know, and you know, with binoculars and spyware, you know, and drive around the base without somebody coming up and questioning me. So how did somebody who was a former member of the CCP military buy, you know, 130,000 something plus acres around, you know, the air base or in Dakota? How did that happen without anybody knowing? Or how about all the marijuana grows in Maine? It's like nobody wakes up until it's too late. And I'm saying we have to do it. You know, Derek said something funny the other day. He goes, you know, Sarah, you broke the stories before they were even stories. I go, well, because he's like, so then when people come in and talk about it, they act like it's new. And I'm thinking like, I talked about that story 10 years ago.
I know, it's not new.
And Derek brought up a really good point. I was trying to stop it before it got bad, but nobody, you know, and then there were other reporters that were doing the same thing. It wasn't just me, but nobody was listening and nobody seemed to care, because people cared more then about lining their pockets, about, you know, whatever else was the issue or the topic of the day. They didn't want to be bothered with, you know, the possibility that this could happen. And now what we see is not only what's happening and the enormity of the deaths. You know, and I'm in agreement with Derek. It's poisoning our populace and killing them and killing our children. But also the fact that, wait a minute, now we not only left it open for our children to be poisoned and for our populace to be more infected than ever before with the narcotics and our responsibility to deter it, but now we've left it wide open so that, like, all of these people we fought for the last 20 years, you know, or so since September 11, 2001, are like cruising up to the border and walking in like, okay, this is good. I'm going to go in and set up shop now. So we don't even know what the threat is. Now the threat is so far greater than we've ever imagined. And that is very gut-wrenching for me as someone who's covered those stories for the majority of my life.
So you look, I know you focus a lot on the border. And as an emergency physician, what I see a lot from the border is the people who fall off the wall, break their ankle, and are stuck in the hospital for like it's terrible. We divide up odd and even months between two hospitals because otherwise we'd just get so overwhelmed with patients. And we know when it's a border month, we call it, okay, we got the border months. We're getting so many patients jumping from the wall. But I've noticed that the people who are coming in don't look the same as they did a few years ago. It used to be, we would call migrants coming in for a better life. But now I see well-dressed people from all over the world. It's not
with Louis Vuittons, and Prada shoes. I'm like, what?
It's amazing and perfect English.
It's so crazy.
And I don't think the Americans realize that there's been such a change in who's coming across the border.
Yeah, I don't think they have. And you bring up very valid points there. I see it myself. I see it whether they're coming in and they have all their clothes in nice little bags and they're walking across with their flip-flops on the lower part of the river. And I'm just like, holy cow, I don't even own a pair of those shoes. If they're knockoffs, they look fabulous because I don't have a pair of Prada tennis shoes. I don't own those. And also the amount of people that, as we've been reporting on, and you brought up a really important point, people that have broken ankles, that have disease, that have, have hurt themselves on this long road, or young children who've been abused sexually or physically. And now all of a sudden, they're coming here and your heart is just broken and you're thinking, this policy is just, there's nothing good about it at all. Because
the healthcare part is also ironic because we're like so careful about COVID. We were so careful about who's coming in for COVID. And now forget COVID. I mean, I'd rather have COVID than influenza these days. It's just a different disease today than it was 4 years ago. But never mind. What about all the tuberculosis outbreaks that we have now?
Multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis.
But yeah, and then measles and other outbreaks that we used to have control over. Even with people coming from the border, we would, make sure that there's vaccines and treatment and people are screened. Now there's no screening, on a health-wise, which seems a little strange. The debates, I don't want to get into the debates, but President Biden did mention, we need to get those machines. We need to get machines. Do you know what he was talking about?
No.
I've been asking people what the machines are.
What machines? I was just trying to figure out the machines.
I've been researching these machines. Actually, I invited to my podcast somebody from Texas that works on technology and fentanyl detection, because I want to find out, is that what he's talking about? Or is it the technology used at like the post office where it was detecting it in the air?
I think that's where they were trying to detect them in the envelopes. That's what I thought at first too. I was thinking like, is he talking about machines so that we could stop it from like traveling by mail? Like maybe, or
the screening and the border. Like I was told that there's new technology. It's called non-invasive inspection technology, where it's kind of like x-ray systems, but where you don't have to like leave the car and you can detect it. And I don't know.
What we need to do is just send a very clear message across. We can put up all the detection machines that we want.
They're you need find upstream. Ways it. You need upstream. You have to go upstream from the border.
Right.
I mean, China says they don't have a fentanyl problem. We had delegates from China come to the United States and they were sent different places to speak to people. I got to speak to them. And these, experts said that they don't have a fentanyl problem, that it's just an American problem. And it's like, that's because your government won't allow it in your country. They would stop it. I mean, it's coming in, right? They have both Mexico and China have a stronger holding on their population than we do. I mean, I don't want to live under that regime, so I'm happy with the freedoms we have in the United States, but they are able to control their population if they wanted to.
Well, they do. They don't allow their population or their nation to be taken advantage of in the same way. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have the freedoms, but you would never, never find, and I could take you right now, we could get on a plane, I could take you to the border with Guatemala right now in Mexico, and you would never see what you see at our border. You would never see it. The only time that Mexico allows that flood to come in is when it's actually so overwhelmed that one or few times I've seen them kind of push their way through. But Mexico expects them to just end up in the United States. They don't expect the people to stay there, not for a long period of time by any means, but they have very stringent border security. And you would never see that here. This has been my question all along. Why are we allowing this to happen? I looked at Kensington, and you're absolutely right. China doesn't have that problem. Guess what? El Salvador doesn't have that problem either. And I'm not in total agreement with how everybody was picked up and put in the prisons there. I believe in a justice system, right? But I also believe that you have to get people off the streets that are holding your country hostage. But you will never see what I saw in Kensington, Philadelphia, anywhere else. I never saw that in Mexico. I haven't seen that in Guatemala, and I've traveled there many times. I haven't seen that in El Salvador. What is happening in America that is leading our populace to destroy themselves, if we're talking about those that are addicted, and allowing, and who are we, and what does this say about us when we allow our nation to be flooded with narcotics, and just allow our streets to be overrun with crime and addiction to the point where our own children can't even walk to a school bus without the fear of being taken out or killed? What has happened to us as a people where we have allowed this to happen? I don't understand that, doctor.
We talked about foreign and international drug policies, right? And the deterrence. Right. Namely China and Mexico, that we don't have enough deterrence, not just at the border of just like having an open border or screening or
right,
something.
Right, but laws, but in but, our
right,
own
but,
laws.
But sometimes deterrence, like, you know, on a higher upstream from that. But I also wonder about our own domestic policies. And those are policies that decrease deterrence, right? Where you can have open drug markets in California, Oregon, Washington, where there's a whole force, and it's a philosophy that I don't agree with, but a philosophy of drug legalizing, drug normalizing, decreasing penalties, increasing commercialization of marijuana.
But we're seeing it's not working right now. It's not working in Oregon.
No, it's destroying us. I think but we're, and like you said, destroying from within. These are our policies. We can't look at China or Mexico when we have these policies on ourselves.
But we also have to realize that we've been our populace has been manipulated and lied to in a lot of these cases where we have, you know, district attorneys that are soft on crime, that do not prosecute. I mean, it was interesting. I saw a picture one of my friends posted from San Francisco where it said, remember, anything more than $950 taken from the store is a crime. Like, you're saying, okay, oh, well, you know, I can go in and take up to $950 or whatever.
That's what's happening. And actually, there's a ballot initiative. I don't know if you heard about it. We have a ballot initiative in California. It's called the Theft, Homeless, Addiction, or Drug Act. And it'll take back Prop 47. So it'll open up. It's a very compassionate, it's bipartisan ballot initiative. It will pull back Prop 47 that says that you're allowed to steal up to $950, and it'll reopen drug courts to get people treatment. So it would help. So it's wonderful, right? Unfortunately, there are government officials who don't like that, and they're going to put a competing initiative and a poison pill to stop that. But the testimony is that people would come and they'd steal $950, but then they'd do that 30 times. They'd go to the Target store at 30, and each time it's $950, so you can't do anything. And it's basically allowing crime. So you've lost the deterrence. And my argument as a physician is when you don't have deterrence, you've lost your compassion. And people saying, oh, we care about these people because they have a problem, so they're allowed to steal and be violent and deal drugs because, well, they have a medical problem. It's like, yes, substance use disorder is a reversible, treatable disease of the brain, but that's not an excuse, and it's not compassionate to then cross a red line and harm other people.
You are so right. And I say this all the time. And I mean, from not only from what we're seeing happening in our inner cities, but I mean, is it compassionate to watch people on the streets? My friend, Jason Jones, he's with Newsmax, and he sent some videos to all of us, you know, where I had been to Kensington many times in Philadelphia, you know, and this is just one community of many. I've seen it actually here in San Antonio at the airport, where people have been, you know, shooting up fentanyl and using God only knows what other type of enhancement drugs, you know, and it's eating away. It's like crock. It's eating away at their skin, and they're sitting in the middle of the street with half of their thigh exposed to the muscle, all of their flesh eaten away, and they're still shooting up. Is that compassionate? Is that a compassionate way of handling this crisis? Or letting little children walk by and step over the needles on their way to the school bus? Is that compassionate? Or going to the border and, you know, and the just the simple act of like watching a child come across that border and start crying in your arms because they had just been raped, or, you know, they had been abused on this long, treacherous journey. Is it compassionate to leave it wide open with no deterrence whatsoever so that the only benefactors of any of this, the only benefactors are the people selling the drugs, the people selling the children, the people raping, the people committing the crimes, the people who own, who are able to go into a store and steal $950, and then the entire community loses In-N-Out Burger or Target, because now all of a sudden the stores can't afford to be in the communities anymore. So now the elderly people that live in the community that used to walk to the store can no longer get there. I mean, it's just a nightmare all the way around for everyone. It's like saying it's not compassionate to have rules in your house with your own children. Like, oh no, I just let my kids do whatever they want. That's fine.
It's interesting you say that, because I always use that analogy also. It's like, you know, sometimes the best parents are the ones who are strict, and you don't do that because you're angry at your kids. It's because you love them.
Right. Because you don't want them to end up, you know, how do I tell this story without? So it is very hard to raise a kid nowadays. You know, I mean, with so much they're exposed to, of course. And I was talking to my children, and in one of the schools that my youngest had gone to, some of the kids that they used to hang out with here, you know, they were telling me, oh, they're smoking cigarettes now. Now they're only 12 years old. The older kids are using crack cocaine. Like, I didn't even know that at that age, you know, like 11, 12, 13, do you know what I'm saying? Like, when I heard from the other kids, what was happening
addiction is a pediatric disease. It starts when you're young. People die in middle school, but the exposure to the brain starts in middle school.
Exactly. And as parents and as people of this amazing nation where we do have a lot of freedom and we have freedom of choice, we also have the freedom to get up and walk our kids to school in the morning, to the bus stop with other parents and protect them. We also have the freedom, and I tell people all the time, to go to the school and talk to their teachers and find out what's going on. We also have the freedom to speak up against atrocities, right? It's not like, oh, we have freedom, so we're going to sit back and let everybody do whatever they want to us. We have the freedom to stand up and say, I don't want this in my community. Why does Kensington look like this? This was a beautiful community where people used to, you know, get together and, you know, go be able to go to shops and hang out and get a coffee. And, you know, maybe in the 1950s, it was pretty cool and it was fun. And now it's just decaying. It looks like a nightmare. It looks like something out of a zombie movie. We have the ability as individuals to stand up and do the right thing. So deterrence, yes, we need it absolutely, but we can't have deterrence if people aren't fighting for deterrence. If we're not like, it's unacceptable. I'm sorry, I'm not going to live in a community like this anymore.
You're right. There's upstream what we want done to protect the entire country. And then at the end of the day, it's you and your family, and you have to protect them. And you got to do what you need to do to protect them, right?
Right. And we got to get out there and do it. And that, and I think that, like, I wish and so educate. Much so that Americans and people from all over the world, even when I'm like in Afghanistan, you know, it's tough. Like the women in Afghanistan, they're going to be the change. They're going to be the reason it's going to change. And I bring that up because I get how tough it is here. I know how tough it is over there. I know how tough it is anywhere in the world to stand up to brutality, because you put everything on the line sometimes. These are bad guys, you know, these are bad people. Yes, communities like Kensington have drug dealers, they're bad guys. But when everyone gets together, when it's not just one of us, but when it's all of us, we're unstoppable. We're unstoppable.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's the power of the parents. And I've seen this before in my career when it came to the opioid prescription epidemic. It wasn't the politicians or the doctors who made the big difference. It was the parent victims who rallied together and demanded change from the opioid prescription problem and got that. And we no longer have an opioid prescription problem. Now we have a fentanyl problem. And I follow the parents, like Derek does. I follow the parents. They're my moral compass. And their voice needs to be put together and heard. And one of the organizations I work for is Families Against Fentanyl, and they want fentanyl to be declared a weapon of mass destruction in order to get at the supply end of the drug.
And that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, to get it.
And keep it in the hospitals. It's got to be in the hospitals where it needs to be.
A medicine is a medicine. This is illicit stuff. This is not anything right, that I prescribe illicit. For, you know, reducing your shoulder when it's dislocated or doing a colonoscopy.
Right.
And then the other parent victims I see now are the ones from marijuana. And I don't know if that's some of your breaking stories now, but I see the same thing happening that we did with tobacco, opioids, fentanyl, and it's like it's normalizing drugs. Then we're seeing side effects. Now we're seeing kids with psychosis, and it's just a matter of time before the lawsuits come and that awareness. But I see the same parent group whose children were are victims of marijuana, that they became psychotic, and with continued use it becomes permanent, or they have cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, and people have died from that. Some people say you don't die from marijuana, you do. And I think the foreign force, I don't know how much you know about it. It's like, if you buy marijuana from a dispensary, is that coming from the United States? Is that U.S. grown, or is that coming from a foreign or illicit grow? How do you even know?
Right. How do we even know? And a lot of these are, you know, grown with pesticides that are from other countries that are not adequately overseen by the United States or by the FDA or by anyone. So we have no idea the kind of poison that we are putting in our bodies and our children are putting in their bodies or in their minds. And, you know, this again goes to show how the United States is really fallen behind in making its number one resource its citizens, right? Our government is supposed to be there to protect us. If it does anything, it's to oversee what's going on here. And what we're seeing is, like you said, you use the parents as your moral compass and as what is happening in the country. And we have more and more every single day parents saying, look, my child was smoking pot. I didn't even think anything bad could happen from this. And now they have psychosis. Now they have permanent brain damage. It appears that they are not going to be the same person they ever were before. We're being lied to. We are being lied to. And for those of you who don't believe it, all you have to do is just look at history to see what happened. I mean, even with the smoking industry.
Wouldn't it be nice if we learned from history?
It would be so amazing. It would be so amazing. I remember talking to my mom, and she used to smoke. My mom, well, she passed away, but, you know, and she was an amazing woman, but she smoked and she was an addict, and, you know, it became her crutch. And I think it was part of the reason why she died, you know, so young too, at, you know, of course, you know, there's a lot of other issues, I'm sure, that come into play. But like before, people used to there were commercials about how great smoking was for you and how amazing it was.
That's right. 3 out of 4 doctors recommend this brand.
Yeah. And when you have a baby, the doctor would just give you a cigarette as soon as you had
And we'd give it to our soldiers and we'd give it at the mental health institutes. And And now
everybody was smoking. People were smoking. My kids don't believe it.
Tell you who does learn from history and learns very well is the distributors, right? They learn the playbook and they do it better each time. They do learn this from history.
The distributors, and that's like where, you know, people like Derek Maltz and others come into play when they said, you know, like there was stuff. I mean, it's not just about the marijuana, and I wish I could remember, but it was like different things and vaping, and there were other issues with like different over-the-counter type of, I guess, enhancers or relaxers that ended up being like, I mean, really like death traps for people, you know, and then so, but it's like learning from history and not making those same mistakes, but it's also standing up once you know it and saying, okay, wait a minute, what is going on here? And what can we do to stop this from continuing?
And I think we have to separate the some of the facts. As some, we put all this in the drug category, so we assume we're only talking about a population who has a substance use disorder and they need compassionate treatment. But and sadly, we don't have the data on it, and I think you know, so many years into the fentanyl problem, we would have this data, but not everybody who dies intended to die of fentanyl, right? Cause, and I know that as an emergency physician, when people wake up after naloxone, I'll ask them, what were you taking? And sometimes it's fentanyl and they need help, but sometimes it's like, no, I swear, doctor, I don't use that stuff. I don't. And they meant to take cocaine, or they thought they were smoking marijuana, but there was some fentanyl residue in there. It's the victims are not always so. The answer is that treatment. We can't treat our way out of it. There is a nefariousness in the other day I was shown a tablet, a white tablet that said Tums on it. A Tums that was fentanyl. It was not. You know, there's a
special
place in hell for someone who
it terrifies me. And then I think to myself, like, you know, we can't trust. And I have to teach my kids that. I go, you can't take anything anyone gives you as far as medication. It comes from us or the doctor.
Period.
Because we don't know if our kids, like the poor child, you know, that just touched something on the carpet, remember, at the daycare center.
Yes, right. And then there's another baby who died renting an Airbnb who died because they didn't clean the carpet well. And there was fentanyl on the carpet.
I was going to ask you a question. I mean, we don't even have numbers of people that have been brought back from Narcan that have, like, maybe mentally have, like, now permanently damaged, right? Or do we?
We do kind of have. We have not. I mean, it's not the full data, but nationally, ONDCP has a data that they get from EMS as far as naloxone. So EMS has very good data on each time. So I get, as a matter of fact, I could read you my little thing today I got.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
Let's see. This comes out every month, and it's from our San Diego EMS system. And so they count how many people got naloxone, how many, and they look over time. So it actually shows me that it's gone down over the past year, the number of naloxone given.
In San Diego.
Yeah. So they have, between July 1st, 2023 and July 1st, 2024, 1,573 patients and 1,863 Narcan, so more. And then you could see, like, over time, July to July, actually last July was down, this July is down, but for over the year, it's kind of gone a little bit less. That's like, it's a snapshot, but it gives you a basic trend. So I think we kind of do. We do have that, but the data that we don't have is of all those people who were woken up with naloxone, how many of them intended to use fentanyl, and how many of them were tricked, right? And that's important, because how are we going to fix this? We're not going to fix this by giving buprenorphine to everybody if, you know, whatever, 25%, 30% of those people, I mean, you know, it's different in different communities. Didn't mean to take that They need a different. They need a different prevention method.
Absolutely, and parents, and I think our parent. I think it's getting better now, based on the coverage that I've been able to do, and you know, talking with experts like you and others like Derek. But you know, telling parents it's okay to talk about addiction, and it's okay to talk about what happened to your child. Don't be ashamed of it. Don't hide it. You know, if somebody or somebody in your family, you know, accidentally took a Percocet or used cocaine or did something and there was fentanyl in it, you need to talk about it, because this is going to show how widespread this, you know, the use of fentanyl is across the country. And especially when you're thinking of it in a sense of like a proxy war, like, why do we have so many pills on the streets right now, you know, that are, you know, poisonous, you know, to the point of death? Like, you take one pill, you're going to die. And, you know, people ask all the time, like, why would the dealer want to kill his, you know, want to kill his client? I'm like, they don't care. They know there's a lot.
Yeah, they don't care. I've had investigative journalists who went to the cartels, and they say, they ask them that question, and they don't care. There'll be somebody else to get it. But the message is, I think, also the question is, like, why are we spending more and more billions of dollars each administration and each year? We spend more and more money on the problem, but we're not making the headway that we should be doing. And I think the problem is that we're not spending the money in the right way. I mean, in order to end a problem, we need to attack the supply. There needs to be primary prevention, and then there needs to be treatment for the people who have a problem. And so we're doing really great as far as treatment and harm reduction, and we could like get into that. But we've moved away from primary prevention. We have moved away from teaching our children that life is hard and there are other ways to deal with adversity rather than going for drugs.
And that adversity is okay. Adversity makes you a better person. Right. It's okay to fall on your face a few times. It's okay to work for $8 an hour. It's okay to struggle and eat top ramen for a week if you have to, or a year. Whatever you got to do. And eventually you're going to work your way. You have a goal. You set goals. You set plans. You move yourself forward. That's okay. And I think you're right. We've made it so that it's like adversity is like an embarrassment. Like, oh, don't talk about your adversity to me. You know, it's like a big deal when people talk about adversity. It used to be adversity was just a part of life. Like, nobody would be like, well, my adversity.
No, they want that on college applications. They put like, what is your adversity? If you need to show that you have one.
Exactly. Instead, now we've made it like this. And I think that's why I brought up Afghanistan to you, is because I would see, you know, in America, we're so blessed, and I'm not saying we shouldn't be, but we are so blessed to have so much. You know, when I would go to the war zones, I would watch the young kids get up, like I would get ready to go out on a mission with like the troops. And I mean, I'd be up at 3:30 a.m. for, you know, before the sunrise. And then I would be astonished. We'd get in the Strikers, we'd head out towards a village, and I would see all of these little kids, like little kids, like I'm not telling you teenagers, I'm talking like 7 years old, maybe a 5 year old among them, a couple of 10 year olds, all of them walking with buckets, you know, and they were heading to a well to get water to bring back to their kalat, to their village. And they would be giggling and laughing. It would be dark. It would be early morning. And you know, talk about adversity. If you try to get my kid out of the bed at 4 a.m. to go get buckets to get some water, I mean, it might well be like, you know, the apocalypse. It's over. It's like they're not going to move. I don't think we understand adversity anymore. And I think you brought up a really great point. I don't think we understand that being a human being requires that we, you know, have some struggles. And that's okay.
Right. It's just, how do you deal with that? You can't just mask it. You have to learn. And there are life skills on how to deal with that. And that's what we should be learning. That's what we should be teaching our kids. Sarah, this has been so much fun. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, it's been great.
Let us know how people want to follow you and your podcast. Where do they go to?
Go to The Sarah Carter Show on any of your podcast platforms. I would love to have you there as well. I want you on the show, Dr. Lev. I would love to have you get on The Sarah Carter Show. I think there's so much that you could teach my audience. And I thank you so much for giving me this time to just kind of hang out and talk with you. It was such a pleasure.
It was. Thank you. And I'll be on your show.
Yes.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.